from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We were down in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit us, and they moved us to the Superdome on Tuesday, and we spent 4 days and three nights there, and they bust us out on Friday.
A first-hand account from a tourist who spent 4 days at the Superdome in New Orleans. But first, is the federal government trying to stem the tide of images coming out of New Orleans by threatening journalists? We'll speak with two reporters who are covering the Katrina disaster. And as Vice President Dick Cheney visits Mississippi, we'll take a look at how his former company, Halliburton, is profiting from the disaster. But first, FEMA lists Pat Robertson's Operation Blessing as one of the top charities to donate to. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A major oil spill caused by Hurricane Katrina is threatening the lower Mississippi River region. According to the Financial Times, up to 3.7 million gallons of crude oil has leaked into the Mississippi, and some of the oil is expected to find its way into the Gulf of Mexico. Officials estimate the spill is about a third the size of the huge oil spill caused by the Exxon Valdez in Alaska in 1989. The spill in the Mississippi began after Hurricane Katrina ruptured a pair of oil storage tanks. In Washington, President Bush took to the airwaves Thursday to address the victims of Hurricane Katrina. He promised each household $2,000 in emergency funds and said individuals living in disaster areas be given evacuee status to make it easier for them to obtain benefits. The president also announced a National Day of Prayer.
Throughout our history, in times of testing, Americans have come together in prayer to heal and ask for strength for the tasks ahead. So I have declared Friday, September the 16th, as a National Day of Prayer and Remembrance.
That was President Bush speaking Thursday. Meanwhile, Vice President Dick Cheney visited the Gulf Coast region for the first time since the hurricane struck. He was on vacation most of last week in Wyoming. On Thursday, he held a brief televised press conference in Gulfport, Mississippi. He hailed the relief effort as, quote, very impressive. During the press conference, one man screamed, "Go F yourself, Mr. Cheney." This is how the scene played out.
As I was talking to the mayor in those areas, one of the things you got...
Mr. Cheney.
You've got to figure out what to do with all of the debris.
Are you getting a lot of that, Mr. Vice President?
And it's the first time I've heard it. He's a friend of John, or of, never mind.
Last year, Cheney made headlines when he approached Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy on the Senate floor and said, quote, F yourself. More questions are being raised about the head of FEMA, Michael Brown. According to Time magazine, Brown may have fabricated parts of his resume. Brown claimed he worked in Edmond, Oklahoma, quote, as an assistant city manager with emergency services oversight. In fact, he was administrative assistant to the city manager. One city official said he was essentially an intern. Brown also claimed he was once the director of Christian Nursing Facility in Oklahoma, but an administrator at the facility told Time Brown was, quote, not a person that anyone here is familiar with. In addition, Brown claims on his resume he won a prize for being outstanding political science professor at Central State University. But according to an official at the school, Brown, quote, wasn't a professor here. He was only a student. Time reports these revelations raise new questions about how rigorously the White House vetted Brown before putting him in charge of FEMA. Most of his work experience prior to joining FEMA dealt with horses. He worked as the head of the International Arabian Horse Association for 11 years and reportedly was forced out of that position. He became the head of FEMA 2 years ago, replacing his college friend, Joe Allball. First Lady Laura Bush has lashed out at hip-hop artists Kanye West, Howard Dean, and others for criticizing her husband's handling of Hurricane Katrina. Last week, West said during a nationally televised NBC telethon, George Bush doesn't care about black people. On Wednesday, Howard Dean said, quote, we must come to terms with the ugly truth that skin color, age, and economics played a deadly role in who survived and who did not. Laura Bush said, quote, I think all of those remarks are disgusting, to be perfectly frank, because, of course, President Bush cares about everyone in our country. A group of Democratic members of Congress are proposing survivors of Hurricane Katrina be exempted from the nation's new bankruptcy law that goes into effect October 17th. The law will make it harder for individuals to file for bankruptcy. A group of Congress members wrote, quote, "We're concerned that just as survivors of Hurricane Katrina are beginning to rebuild their lives, the new bankruptcy law will result in a further and unintended financial whammy." In other economic news, President Bush has issued an executive order that will allow federal contractors to underpay workers helping to rebuild the Gulf Coast region. Under the Davis-Bacon law, federal contractors are required to pay workers at least the prevailing wages in the area where the work is conducted. It applies to federally funded construction projects such as highways and bridges. But on Thursday, Bush exempted federal contractors working on the reconstruction of the region. Democratic Congressmember George Miller of California said, quote, "The administration is using the devastation of Hurricane Katrina to cut the wages of people desperately trying to rebuild their lives and their communities." Meanwhile, the Reuters news agency is reporting Canadian flags are flying in parts of St. Bernard Parish, Louisiana, after a Canadian search and rescue team helped save trapped residents. According to one Louisiana state senator, the Canadians showed up to help 5 days before the U.S. military. In other news on international aid, Florida Republican Senator Mel Martinez has said the U.S. government should accept Cuba's offer to send hundreds of doctors to treat victims of Hurricane Katrina. The U.S. State Department has so far not taken Cuba up on the offer. The chair of the September 11th Commission has publicly criticized the government's response to the hurricane and flooding. Thomas Kane said, quote, "The same mistakes made on 9/11 were made over again, in some cases worse. Those are system-wide failures that can be fixed and should have been fixed right away," he said. In other news, a grand jury has indicted a political action committee formed by House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. The PAC accepted $120,000 in allegedly illegal corporate campaign contributions during the 2002 legislative election. The money helped Republicans in Texas secure control of the state house for the first time since Reconstruction. The state legislators then redrew the Texas congressional map, costing Democrats 6 seats in the U.S. House. Oil giant ExxonMobil is expecting to report second quarter profits of over $10 billion, making it the most profitable single quarter for any company ever. This means ExxonMobil averaged making over $4.5 million every hour for the past 3 months. During that same period, gas prices shot up to record highs. Meanwhile, the Energy Department is warning consumers in the Northeast to expect their winter heating bills to jump over 30%. In Iraq, the U.S. military is threatening to wage an all-out assault on the town of Tal Afar in northern Iraq. The U.S. said it wants to rid the town of what it describes as insurgents. Meanwhile, the United Nations is calling on U.S. and Iraqi officials to investigate reports of extrajudicial executions being carried out by pro-government death squads and systematic torture inside Iraqi police stations. 2 weeks ago, 36 bound and blindfolded men believed to have been Sunni Muslims were found tortured and shot near the Iranian border. On Thursday, police said they found 14 more bound bodies near Baghdad. At the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, more than 200 detainees have entered their second month of a hunger strike. In Egypt, state newspapers are reporting that President Hosni Mubarak has won a fifth six-year term. The election was billed as Egypt's first contested presidential election, but opposition parties complain the election was a sham with widespread voting abuses and irregularities. And in Nepal, at least 73 protesters have been detained over the past 5 days of demonstrations against the king, who seized complete control of the country in February. Some 5,000 protesters attempted to get into the capital city where anti-king rallies are banned.
They used to tell me I was building a dream. So I followed the mall. When there was free to fly, all guns to bear. I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in this line waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad and made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done, brother. Can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower.
Famed New Orleans musician Dr. John singing Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? Lyrics by Yip Harburg here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. The journalists who have been covering Hurricane Katrina have literally been risking their lives for the last week. Reporters have been stationed in and around New Orleans since the hurricane hit and have tirelessly reported on the devastation to the city. Some journalists have expressed enormous outrage at government officials for their slow response. A few television reporters openly broke down on air as they reported on the horrific conditions and the desperation of the victims. Reporters have witnessed the militarization of the city and are starting to feel the effects of the government crackdown on information gathering. FEMA is now rejecting requests by journalists to accompany rescue boats searching for storm victims. In addition, journalists are being asked not to photograph any dead bodies in the region.
NBC News anchor Brian Williams reported on his blog that police officers had been seen aiming their weapons at members of the media. And a blogger named Bob Brigham wrote a widely read dispatch that the National Guard in Jefferson County are under orders to turn all journalists away. Brigham writes, quote, "Bush is now censoring all reporting from New Orleans, Louisiana. The First Amendment sank with the city." Earlier this week, Reporters Without Borders issued a warning about police violence against journalists working in New Orleans. They highlighted two cases. In one case, police detained a Times-Picayune photographer and smashed his equipment to the ground after he was seen covering a shootout with police. In the second case, a photographer from the Toronto Star was detained by police, his photos taken from him when police realized he'd snapped photos of a clash between them and citizens who the police claimed were looters. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan was asked about the crackdown yesterday.
There are a couple of issues that are developing that are of concerns to journalists down in Louisiana and Mississippi. One of them is FEMA refusing to take reporters and photographers when they're going to recover the bodies, ostensibly because they don't want pictures of them on the news. But this also is at the same time as reporters are discovering that access is being barred to them to places by the military, to places where they previously went. Brian Williams' own blog reports an instance of a police officer turning a gun on reporters.
Sorry, I haven't blogged today, so I haven't seen
well,
some of those reports.
Well, if you check it out, you'll find he has three instances in there of the military being hostile to journalists.
I know that the military, and I think even Coast Guard is taking steps to try to make sure reporters can go along on some of the efforts that the humanitarian assistance efforts and the search and rescue efforts. That was my understanding when we were there on Friday visiting with a lot of the Coast Guard people that had been working around the clock on search and rescue operations. You're first statement that you made, I think you need to look further into that because I don't think that's an accurate characterization. I saw some reports to that effect, and my understanding is it was not an accurate characterization. Certainly, I think we all want to keep in mind the sensitivities that will arise when we begin a larger undertaking of recovering bodies that will be found. As I said, it's going to be an ugly situation when those floodwaters ultimately recede and we go in and start recovering larger numbers of bodies of people who have lost their lives. Those are people who had families and friends, and we hope everybody will show the dignity and proper dignity and respect. But in terms of the characterization that you made, I don't think that's accurate.
I have a quote from FEMA about it saying the recovery of victims is being treated with dignity and the utmost respect, and we have requested that no photographs of the deceased be made by the media. And yet the bodies themselves, tragically, are a very large part of this story. And to
That's the full statement.
That was White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan speaking on Thursday, being questioned by reporters at the White House. Joining us in our D.C. studio is Tim Harper, a reporter with the Toronto Star. He was with his photographer, Lucas Alanyuk, the photographer from the Toronto Star, whose photos were taken from him by police. And here with us in New York is Jackie Suen. She just flew in last night, an independent filmmaker with Big Noise Films. And we'll talk with her about what happened to her in a minute. But first, we go to Tim Harper in Washington. Explain when you were in New Orleans with your photographer and what happened.
Sure. It was a week ago, Thursday. It was a day that things were quite clearly out of control. It was before any federal troops had come in to try to take control of the situation. New Orleans authorities were clearly way over their head at that point, and looting had been breaking out over the past 24 hours everywhere. We drove, Lucas Oleniak and I drove into the city. We were a couple of blocks away from the convention center when he noticed on the left what looked to be perhaps the start of a shootout. We noticed a New Orleans ETF, Emergency Task Force, officer crouching behind his car with his gun drawn. Lucas jumped out of the car. As soon as he did, we heard a quick pop, 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 and gunfire was coming from an apartment block and being returned by the police. I was told in no uncertain terms at gunpoint to get the hell out of the area, and I complied as best I could. But Lucas was caught essentially in the gunfire because New Orleans police pulled up behind him and started shooting over his shoulder. So during the 15-minute or so standoff that ensued, he was taking pictures alongside New Orleans officers as they were caught in this standoff. Now, subsequently, they did get two suspects out of the apartment block where this incident was happening. And while Lucas was shooting, they administered a rather fierce beating on these two guys. And I guess that was the problem. As soon as they realized that the beating of the suspects was being captured on film, one officer tried to rip the camera off his shoulder. His press tag was ripped off. Eventually, they got one camera and started messing with the camera, trying to get the pictures out, fearful that they were going to ruin his camera. He showed them how to get the images out. His second camera was ripped from his shoulder at that time. And when he asked whether he could get his images back, he was threatened with having his neck broken, had guns pointed at him. I came back to try to help him. I had guns pointed at me. I was told to turn my car around, stop, or I'll shoot, and had a shotgun pointed at the windshield. So the bottom line is about 350 images that Lucas Oleniak took will never be seen. And I thought almost equally as important, ripping off his press tag at that point and leaving him without any press accreditation, driving around in the city in that situation, made him incredibly vulnerable. It was a very dangerous situation.
So, in other words, they did not initially try to stop his shooting of photographs of the shootout. It was only when
they started to beat
the prisoners that they had grabbed that they became concerned.
Yeah, no, it's not clear that at that point whether they allowed him to keep taking the pictures because obviously they were worried about sniper fire coming from the apartment and didn't want to do anything to endanger themselves. But nobody tried to intervene. He actually at one point ran across the street from, he had taken shelter behind a light standard, and then while the shooting was going on, ran across about a quarter block length to get behind a cruiser for better protection beside another officer shooting. So no, there was no move to stop him from taking pictures while they were involved in the shootout. Mm.
Tim Harper is a reporter with the Toronto Star. His photographer, Lucas Oleniuk, with the Toronto Star, had his film taken. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Jackie Suen to talk about her experiences as she was filming as well. Stay with us.
Yeah, please come to the crossroads.
Okay.
Neville Brothers, My Blood. Neville Brothers, also famed musicians from New Orleans. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 350 stations around the country, on Pacifica NPR and low-power FM stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, as well on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and as well on Channel 375 on DirecTV. We're podcasting and video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our guest Tim Harper of the Toronto Star, telling us what happened when he was covering New Orleans, and Jackie Suen of Big Noise Films, who's done a number of films around the world, spent a good deal of time in Iraq covering the invasion and occupation in the time before. Jackie, you just flew in late last night from New Orleans. Tell us about your experience there.
Well, the experience that with the police was 2 days ago. We were filming in the Ninth Ward, which is one of the more dangerous areas, supposedly, but also one of the hardest hit areas, and one of the areas where a lot of rescue operations haven't gone into, especially the lower Ninth Ward. And we were just on the edge of that, and we were filming with another photographer and a journalist. Curfew was approaching, but it wasn't quite there yet, and we had gone about the city at the same time of night other times. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, literally, there were four SUVs and a Humvee pulled up. And without any warning, DEA, Border Patrol, Louisiana Police Department, and National Guard forces came out with their guns raised, pointed at our heads, and said, "Looters will be shot." And we just began yelling as fast as we could, "We're pressed, we're pressed, we're pressed." And we had my camera in my hand while that was going on, and they kept yelling at us, "Looters will be shot." This went on for a little while.
Were you with a resident of the Ninth Ward?
We were with a resident of the Ninth Ward who was also okay. We were all okay in the end. We talked them down. We were able to tell them we would just leave as quickly as possible. They also wanted to make sure that the resident of the Ninth Ward left. He was planning on staying, but they wanted to make sure that he left with us. And I think what we did was we really experienced more than anything, I mean, martial law as it was being enacted upon the city and the fear that it was causing in all the residents. And the very next day, I mean, I got two more phone calls from residents who were inside who had suddenly decided to leave because they said they were being harassed and intimidated by the police, being searched on street corners, having guns pointed at them.
To say the least, you've been in a lot of dangerous situations. How did this rate, and how afraid were you?
I have to say that both me and the other journalist who is with me, both of us who have covered the Iraq War, I mean, this was one of the more frightening situations because I really had the impression that they were willing to shoot anybody and anything. They were incredibly energized, incredibly amped up. And also that whole area was, very lawless, as was said. But the police had a fear, and they were willing to intimidate anybody who was there. What was eerie was also, though, it looked a lot like Iraq. I mean, the only times that we did see National Guard, they were patrolling the streets in the same way in the Ninth Ward, whereas in the downtown area, they were perhaps more friendly, talking to people, etc. In that area of the city, it was very much looked like an occupied city. They were walking in formation. They had their guns out and pointed at the houses. So it was very frightening to see that in our country.
Chucky, and I'd like to ask Tim Harper also, this whole issue of lawlessness and looting and attacks has gotten a lot of attention in the past few days, many African-American leaders claiming that it has been overblown, others saying no, and even the officials in New Orleans not quite being united. We've heard on the one hand that the allegations of rapes and murders that occurred in the Superdome have been discounted, and yet the mayor of New Orleans yesterday admitted that yes, some had occurred. So, I mean, what did you see on the ground in terms of this whole issue of the extent of the looting and the lawlessness?
I saw very little looting in the areas I was in, to be honest, in the Ninth Ward, which I was surprised I thought I would see. In fact, the resident we went with expected to find his house looted, and he came back, and everything was perfectly intact and there, and his neighborhood was similarly hadn't been looted at all. It was very much the community was staying there. So I think perhaps it depends on block to block. The things that seemed to be looted were the shopping centers downtown and that sort of thing. But more than anything, talking to other residents, it seems like a lot of these things are being used as scare tactics amongst the residents themselves.
And Tim Harper, what did you see in terms of actual looting or lawlessness and credible reports that you received?
Well, we witnessed looting on a number of occasions, and in fact, we witnessed widely divergent responses to it. One morning, driving into the city in Kenner, which is the district not far from the airport, Lucas again, where we witnessed and we shot an armed takedown of a looter in a convenience store, who was handcuffed at gunpoint and laid face down in the asphalt. But then the next day, for example, driving along Magazine, getting into New Orleans, a giant Whole Foods had just been looted. And people were just pushing grocery carts down the street filled with water and non-perishables. And the police that drove by just moved over into the left lane so as not to impede their progress and just let them head off wherever they were heading with it. I think at that point, at that point in the saga, the realization, of course, had kicked in that people were looting in order to survive and to help others survive, and the police didn't seem to be impeding their progress.
I was wondering if what we're seeing in New Orleans is what we rarely see in this modern age of journalism, certainly when it comes to Iraq, and that is unembedded reporting. There were no troops there to embed with. Now you have the president coming late to this, saying that bodies are not to be filmed. Of course, how they impose that rule in Iraq, you're not supposed to see body bags or, you know, flag-draped coffins. But right now, what the American people have seen on their TV screens is reporters at the bullseye, which is what we rarely see, at the target end, because there are no troops that they are with. They're there with the victims. They're crying. They're not in air-conditioned spaces. They're subjected to the same horrendous conditions in New Orleans, and they're experiencing the victims. Jackie, Tim, I'll start with you. Do you have any view on that idea of us seeing the power of what it means to see these images, and the administration now very much trying to catch up and stop this from coming out?
Well, I just wanted to make one point. As Amy, somebody mentioned to me yesterday that just as the Pentagon had embedded reporters with soldiers during the Iraq invasion, so as inevitably your sentiments mesh with the soldiers. They're there to help you and protect you. Hundreds of reporters in the last 10 days or so have been embedded with the poverty-stricken people of New Orleans. And I think there's a possibility that this is changing some views, because when you're embedded with people, and in fact, when I say embedded, I mean there's... It doesn't matter how much money you have in your pocket in New Orleans. Everybody was the same. There was nothing to buy. There was the playing field was leveled. And when you're embedded with people suffering like that, you tend to be sympathetic to their point of view. You tend to wonder, where is the help? You tend to wonder why these people have been left behind, and you identify with them. And I'm wondering whether in this country in the next little while there might be a closer look at how so many people in New Orleans, for example, and Mississippi, where we were, are living in abject poverty. And how do they fall under the radar? Maybe it's time to take a look at this again, and maybe some views could be changed because of this.
Jackie Sewin, your final comment.
I definitely agree that from the victims to the people who were able to survive the hurricane, people are very critical of how this is dealt with, and that has to do a lot with the power of the stories that are getting out.
Amazing to see across the political spectrum when you see these images unfiltered from conservative Republicans to progressives, people denouncing what has happened. And you can only wonder if we had seen these same images when it came to the invasion and occupation of Iraq, if people would have the same response. I want to thank you so much, Tim Harper, reporter with the Toronto Star, for joining us in Washington, D.C., and Jackie Sewin, independent filmmaker with Big Noise Films here in New York, both just back from covering New Orleans. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we turn now to an issue, Juan, that you've been covering in the New York Daily News, and that is the issue of who gets their charities on the web pages of the government websites.
Yes. Well, soon after Hurricane Katrina crashed onto the Gulf Coast, the Federal Emergency Management Agency promoted a list of charities on its website that were accepting donations for hurricane relief. Dozens of media outlets, including the New York Times, CNN, the Associated Press, duly reprinted FEMA's list, as did many local governments, state and local governments. The top three charities listed were the Red Cross, Operation Blessing, and Operation Second Harvest, which Operation Blessing was founded by Christian televangelist Pat Robertson. At a news conference Thursday, FEMA Chief Michael Brown was questioned about this issue.
FEMA has three charities listed in a press release that they sent out. One of them is Operation Blessing. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me why that charity is on the list and who put it there?
I'm sure the staff did, and it's there because they've offered to help and are doing good work.
Operation Blessing is a Pat Robertson organization. Should that be on there?
If they're willing to work, if they're willing to help, we're not turning help away. We're not turning away help from anybody.
In the New York Daily News, Juan Gonzalez provides some background for Pat Robertson and Operation Blessing. We're also joined on the phone by Max Blumenthal, a regular contributor to The Nation magazine. His latest article is called Pat Robertson's Katrina Cash. We welcome Max. Juan, why don't you start? A very interesting piece that you wrote, Disaster Used as Political Payoff.
Yes, Amy. Well, the reality is that Operation Second Blessing or Second Blessing has been part of the Robertson empire now for many years. He's the chairman of the board himself. His wife is a vice president. One of his sons is a member of the board of directors. So it's wholly a nonprofit foundation that is controlled by Robertson. Interestingly enough, when I checked their latest 990 for the fiscal year ending of March of 2004, they give hundreds of grants for a few thousand dollars to churches all around the United States. But the single largest recipient of assistance from Second Blessing is Pat Robertson's Christian Broadcasting Network. It received $885,000 in grants from the charity. For what purposes, I'm not quite clear. But the other part of it is also that Second Blessing has had a less than stellar record. Back in the mid-1990s, during the Rwandan genocide, Robertson appealed for assistance for Operation Second Blessing on his 700 Club for money to fly relief supplies to the Rwandan refugees in Zaire. Turns out that an investigation later by the Virginia Attorney General's office revealed that the planes that were bought by the charity were actually ferrying mining equipment for a diamond mining operation, the African Development Corporation. And lo and behold, who is the principal shareholder of this private corporation? None other than Pat Robertson himself. He eventually had to reimburse his own charity $400,000 for the fact that these planes were being used not for charitable work but for his own enrichment. Although that mine itself ended up collapsing, so Robertson's use of this charity has had problems in the past, and the fact that the federal government listed it among the top three charities before the Catholic Charities, before the United Jewish Appeal, before AmeriCares, before all kinds of other charities that have been in existence for decades and decades, is quite unusual.
And let's not forget, this comes right after Pat Robertson says on his 700 Club program broadcast all over this country, said that essentially that Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez should be assassinated. This comes a week or two after that. Max Blumenthal, can you continue along the lines that Juan Gonzalez is talking about, your research into Pat Robertson?
Well, with respect to the case that Juan was talking about, which was in 1994 when Robertson bilked Operation Blessing donors out of money for to ferry mining equipment into Zaire, which was a direct partnership with Mobutu Sese Seko. He was actually this scheme was actually exposed by a reporter from a small paper in Virginia, and the Virginia's Office of Consumer Affairs initiated an investigation and determined that Robertson willfully induced contributions from the public through the use of misleading statements and other implications. That's a direct quote. So they determined that he bilked his donors, and the attorney general at the time, a guy named Mark Early, agreed. But he overruled the Office of Consumer Affairs recommendation for Robertson's criminal prosecution. This might have put Robertson in jail and ended his entire ministry. So who is Mark Early? Mark Early, during his campaign for attorney general, was essentially bought off by Pat Robertson. Pat Robertson donated $35,000 to his campaign. That was his largest contribution. Now, today, Mark Early is the head of Prison Fellowship Ministries. He was appointed by former Richard Nixon's dirty trickster Chuck Colson. And Prison Fellowship Ministries is very similar to Operation Blessing. They're a faith-based social work group that has accepted White House Office of Faith-Based Initiative money to do social work, and they're actually supposedly doing some relief work in Louisiana. So I think this reflects, the larger hustle going on, which is being propagated by the White House. In 2001, Joe Alba, who is a former member of Bush's Iron Triangle, with Karen Hughes and Karl Rove, his Texas team, was appointed head of FEMA. And he said, he said before Congress that FEMA was a giant bureaucratic entitlement program and that it should basically be whittled down and its work should be delegated to faith-based organizations. So we're seeing that being implemented through his successor, Mike Brown, who is his former college roommate and was appointed FEMA head solely because he was Joe Alba's former college roommate. So we're seeing groups like there were only two secular groups on FEMA's list. And currently, I think there are scores of secular groups doing relief work. Pat Robertson's group, Operation Blessing, is not doing relief work in Louisiana. They, I turned on the 700 Club, which is Pat Robertson's daily TV show, where he called for Hugo Chavez's assassination, to get a sense of the kind of work they were doing. And what I saw were profiles of white evangelicals who had suffered as a result of Hurricane Katrina. And undoubtedly, a lot of white evangelicals in the Gulf Coast of Mississippi have suffered. When it came to covering the plight of people in New Orleans who are largely poor and largely black, I haven't witnessed any coverage of this disaster that's so racist as I saw on the 700 Club. On the September 5th edition of the 700 Club, there was a report from a guy named Gary Lane, a CBN correspondent from outside the New Orleans Convention Center, which is where thousands of impoverished disaster victims were held without food and water for some days in some cases. And Lane declared, a number of possessions left behind suggest the mindset of some of the evacuees. They include this voodoo cup with the saying, "May the curse be with you." And then a picture of a voodoo cup from like a souvenir shop in New Orleans came on the screen. Then he started showing piles of music CDs. It reminded me of when the U.S. Invaded Panama and opened up Manuel Noriega's desk and found porno magazines. It was almost like a psyops operation to discredit the evacuees as people not worthy of aid. And the 700 Club also featured a reverend named Wellington Boone, who's a far right-wing black minister who seemed like he was invited to provide a counterpoint to Jesse Jackson, who'd been all over the news. And Boone declared in an interview on CBN's website, separate from his 700 Club appearance, that that these people who have gone through slavery, segregation, and the Voting Rights Act are doing this to themselves. So what I saw in Pat Robertson's operation was an intentional attempt to demonize the people who had been victimized by Hurricane Katrina and by the response of the government in order to justify whatever his operation was doing on the ground, which seemed to be directed at helping only a certain subset of the hurricane victims, which were in his ministry's network, as it were. And, when I say network, I mean within the network of the churches who he's distributing cash grants to.
Well, if I can, just to get back to that, also, I think in the coming weeks and months, we're going to have to be very vigilant on the number of groups and organizations that attempt now to feast on the federal aid that will be going into this area. And Robertson clearly seems to be one of them, because remember, he also was involved in Liberia, where he was a backer on the 700 Club of Charles Taylor, the former thug and dictator who was later indicted by the United Nations for war crimes. And he was backing Taylor on his 700 Club, visited there several times, and at the same time was investing in a gold mine in a franchise that had been given to him by Charles Taylor. So you have this situation with Pat Robertson actually directly, personally profiting from investments in Africa while at the same time trying to get charity money here and then ignoring the black communities here in the United States.
Well, Charles Taylor had a 10% stake in Robertson's company. I mean, they were literally business partners.
Yes, but I also wrote this week just briefly about the oil companies, too, because the Shell Oil Company on September 1st posted on their website a warning against price gouging, gasoline price gouging, to the American public, and urged Americans to report to their local governments any price gouging. On the same day that Shell posted that announcement on its website, it raised the price of a wholesale price of gasoline to all its dealers in New York by 20 cents a gallon, and has increased the price of the wholesale price of its gasoline six times in the last 10 days, even even though only one of its refineries down there, the three it has in the Gulf Coast area, is even temporarily down. And, of course, all the oil that they are now charging these extra price for was refined way before the hurricane even occurred. So you have the oil companies also now feasting on this tragedy, and we're going to be having to watch more and more of these hypocrites who say that one thing to the public, but then end up doing another thing in reality.
I want to thank Max Blumenthal for joining us, regular contributor to The Nation, author of the recent article, Pat Robertson's Katrina Cash. And Juan, thanks for investigating this. His piece, Juan's piece, appears in the New York Daily News, Disaster Used as Political Payoff. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll speak to Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill, who is now covering the situation in New Orleans, and also Democracy Now! Chief Engineer Mike DeFilippo, who went to Mississippi to help people there in need. Stay with us.
No. Nobody knows, Lord, the trouble I see. Lord, nobody knows. My sorrow, yeah, nobody knows.
Mahalia Jackson, Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen. Mahalia Jackson was born in New Orleans in 1911. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Vice President Dick Cheney and his wife Lynn flew into Gulfport, Mississippi Thursday. While he was speaking to reporters, his news conference was interrupted.
As I was talking to the mayor in those areas, one of the things you got...
You've
got to figure out what to do with all of the debris.
Are you getting a lot of that, Mr. Vice President?
And it's the first time I've heard it. It's a friend of John, or of, never mind.
That was Dick Cheney in Gulfport, Mississippi. Gulfport, the home of a naval base that it, along with a few other military facilities, has just about to be revamped, rebuilt with a $12 million fund that has been given to a $12 million award to Halliburton Corporation. Dick Cheney, the former CEO of Halliburton. Joining us on the line right now is Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent, has made his way down to the New Orleans Baton Rouge area and in the long drive has been researching Halliburton and Dick Cheney in Gulfport. Welcome, Jeremy.
It's good to be with you, Amy and Juan. And I sort of was on the same travel schedule as Dick Cheney. I was in Mississippi at the same time he was, and then arrived in Louisiana around the same time he was here. And then I spent the better part of yesterday afternoon traveling around New Orleans. And on the issue of Dick Cheney, you know, it's very difficult with what we've seen over the past 5 years or so with this administration and the sort of blatant cronyism, the corporate handouts, the friends of the administration, in some cases directly to members of the administration. It's sort of hard to be surprised at the appearance of fixing policies or profiteering from crises at the expense of the poor. And the big question that all of us need to ask ourselves is, would this have happened and would the aftermath have been so bad if New Orleans was actually New England? And it's pretty clear that the answer to that is no. In fact, we know how the administration responded to these kinds of disasters when we look at how Bush handled Florida and the hurricane there when his brother was governor, and we know that the occupation of Iraq would look very different if the children of the Bushes and the Cheneys and the senators and the CEOs had to serve in the military. There simply would be no occupation. So what we're seeing here, it's a matter of priorities and how you choose to respond to things and the kinds of policies that you implement. And as for Cheney, I think it could be, on the one hand, a sort of sick symbolic coincidence that he kicked off his tour down here in this utterly devastated region in Gulfport, Mississippi, because that's one of the main areas where his so-called former company, Halliburton, where its subsidiary, Kellogg Brown & Root, has a lucrative contract to rebuild the damaged and destroyed military facilities. As you said, KBR is going to receive about $12 million for work at one naval station. It's going to get roughly another $5 million at another station. But what's more significant and what people are not focusing on is that Kellogg Brown & Root is also now traveling throughout the region assessing damage to, for instance, the pumps in New Orleans and the infrastructure of the city. They've already begun providing services for some 500 Department of Homeland Security personnel. They've set up a camp for the Mississippi Power Company. And so they're setting up these same kinds of camps that we see in Guantanamo and Iraq and elsewhere to service the rebuilding of the Gulf area here of the South. And there's a real sick irony here as well, as Dick Cheney comes to these areas now where his company Halliburton and KBR are getting these lucrative contracts, and that is that there are hundreds of Halliburton workers missing that are unaccounted for, as Halliburton stocks are hitting a 52-week high because of Hurricane Katrina. And it's interesting that after Dick Cheney was told twice to go F himself by that angry person behind him, you hear him asked if he's been hearing those sentiments a lot, and of course Cheney says that was the first time that he's heard it. Well, that's probably true for Dick Cheney to be on the receiving end of that, but as we know, and as you pointed out in the news headlines today, he said almost the exact same thing to Vermont Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy. So I think it's on the one hand, you could view Cheney's choice of areas, and some residents charge that he went only to rich, white, Republican areas that were hit by Katrina. You could look at it as a sick coincidence that he ends up going where Halliburton has its contract, or you could view it as part of the bigger picture of Halliburton receiving no-bid contracts in Iraq and being one of the chief profiteers of the occupation of Iraq as well.
Jeremy Scahill talking to us from Baton Rouge right now, talking about Dick Cheney, Halliburton, the connections, and Gulfport as well. Jeremy, can you describe your trip down and what it has looked like as you've made your way through the states into New Orleans?
Well, you really start to see when you get into Mississippi and cross over to Louisiana, you start to see the sort of outside of the damage of Hurricane Katrina. You'll see twisted road signs, etc. But even here in Baton Rouge, where I am right now, a supporter who's trying to get Democracy Now! On the air, she had her home destroyed. A tree fell on top of it, and so they have lost their home. And this is about an hour north of New Orleans. But right when you start to drive toward New Orleans, you start to see the massive flooding of the city. And I yesterday was in Jefferson Parish, where people were getting their last opportunity to go by boat into their homes and take out what things they could and then retrieve them, because now Jefferson Parish is going to be locked down for the next 3 weeks, and people are being told that they won't be allowed to go back in. And this is happening as they're doing forced evictions in other parts of the city. But one of the things, Amy, that is not being talked about a lot is the fact that the east of New Orleans, of the city of New Orleans, has largely been untouched by anyone. Rescue workers haven't made it there. Journalists haven't made it there. I was talking to a Louisiana state trooper yesterday who said that he flew over the area in a helicopter, and he said that there are bodies and animals floating everywhere, and that the military is guarding the area, preventing people from coming in on boats, that they have M-16s, and that they're preventing people from coming in. There are reports that in one school, for instance, in that area, that there could be upwards of hundreds of bodies in the east of New Orleans, and people are not able to get in there as well. You know, right now the official death toll of Hurricane Katrina stands at something like 294, but as we hear those numbers, we have to understand that in St. Gabriel's, which is not far from Baton Rouge, where I am right now, they have set up a massive warehouse that is going to serve as the main morgue. They've brought in more than 25,000 body bags into the area. So we're just now at the beginning of what is going to be a very, very horrifying aftermath as the city itself dries up.
Well, Democracy Now! Engineer Mike DeFilippo has been volunteering with rebuilding efforts in Alabama and Mississippi. He joins us on the phone from Wiggins, Mississippi.
It's great to have you with us, Flip. Mike DeFilippo joining us along with Jeremy Scahill. Hi, Flip.
How are you doing, Amy?
Hi. Can you talk about, as we listen to Jeremy describing his experience as he's in the area, what you've been doing there and what you've seen? You're not far from Biloxi, is that right? And we're recently there.
Well, I was definitely recently in Biloxi. We then went down Route 10 over to Gulfport, and now we're about 35 or so miles north of Gulfport in a little town called Wiggins, Mississippi, doing some help here. And everyone I've talked to, everyone I've spoken to, people outside the Trent Lott Middle School, which is just down in Pascagoula, actually, all the way out, everyone I've spoken to has been really disappointed and said, you know, that FEMA's response has been dismal. That comparison that some of the media has made of the idea of Terry Schiavo and people coming in, you know, Congress coming into session late at night just to vote on Terry Schiavo, and then everybody just like sitting back and not really showing the same, at least even the similar kind of concern for the victims of Hurricane Katrina, that really rings home with a lot of people, and everybody's really angry and really disgusted with some of the lack of consideration for their situation.
And in terms of the relief efforts at this point and the attempts for people to begin the rebuilding process, in the towns that you've been at, what's it been like?
Well, definitely when you head out by closer to shore, Biloxi, Gulfport, Pascagoula, Pas Christian, Long Beach, all those areas, when you get within 15, 20 miles from the shore, most of the area you'll see has been completely devastated. And there's just roofs in parts of Biloxi that don't even have a foundation they belong to anymore. The actual house below that roof is nowhere to be found.
Mike, we only have a few seconds, but can you talk about what you've been doing, the camp you've been building for people, for people who are perhaps going to make their way from places like Jefferson County?
Well, where I'm at here is a place called Camp Tiac in Wiggins, Mississippi, and there's the possibility, and there's a pretty good possibility that folks who are going to be, who are still coming out of you know, looking for places to stay, could even be staying here. This is a Boy Scout camp that can take a large number of people. It's 1,500 acres of camp, and it was just complete. It was, you know, seriously devastated. But now we just got water back yesterday. Got electricity back yesterday. It was enlarged. You know, a great deal of buildings all around this area. Trees fall off it, and the electrical service gets pulled off the wall, and it's something that the electric company won't do. They'll only fix your electrical lines up to the house. If something's pulled off your house, meter boxes and stuff like that, they won't do it. You have to get either a private contractor to do it or get it, you know, do it yourself and get it inspected.
Well, Flip, we want to thank you very much for being with us and doing the work you're doing right now in Wiggins, Mississippi. Mike DeFilippo is Democracy Now! Chief Engineer. Looking forward to seeing you back next week. Jeremy Scahill speaking to us from Baton Rouge. Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting from the area on Monday. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadoush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Susie Salami, Maddie Harper, Nell Geiser. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.